Chapter 1. Special Nonsense. Einstein's first professional act upon reviewing the facts was the equivalent of saying, "But the emperor is not wearing any clothes." Except what he said was, "The ether does not exist." The first message of the special theory of relativity is that since the ether is undetectable and, in effect, useless, there is no reason to continue the search for it. It is undetectable because every attempt to measure it or determine its quality, culminating with the Michelson-Morley experiment, failed utterly even to indicate its presence. It is useless because light propagation can be envisioned as the propagation of energy through empty space, in vacuo, according to Maxwell's field equations, as well as it can be envisioned as a disturbance of the ether medium. Einstein stated clearly what already was implicit in Maxwell's equations. Maxwell was the discoverer of the electromagnetic field. "The electromagnetic fields," he wrote, "are not states of a medium, the ether, and are not bound down to any bearer, but they are independent realities which are not reducible to anything else." This assertion was supported by the inability of physicists to detect the ether. With this statement, Einstein brought to a close the illustrious history of mechanics, the idea that physical events are explicable in terms of things. Classical mechanics is the story of objects and forces between them. It was a remarkable break from a three-century-old tradition to assert blatantly in the early 1900s that electromagnetic fields involve no object whatever, that they are not states of the ether medium, but ultimate irreducible realities in themselves. Henceforth, as in quantum mechanics, there would be no concrete imagery associated with physical theory. Both relativity and quantum theory heralded the unprecedented remoteness from experience which has characterized physical theory ever since. In fact, the trend is continuing. As though governed by an inexorable law, physics is becoming more and more abstract as it covers wider and wider tracts of experience. Only the future will tell if this trend is reversible. The second victim of Einstein's inability to see clothes that weren't there was absolute non-motion. Why should we make one particular frame of reference privileged in respect to all others by saying that it alone absolutely is not moving? It may be desirable theoretically, but since such a frame of reference does not constitute a part of our experience, it should be disregarded. It is intolerable to place in a theoretical structure a characteristic which has no corresponding characteristic in our system of experience. In one stroke, Einstein eliminated the two major physical and philosophical blocks to a radically new way of perceiving reality. In one stroke, Einstein eliminated the two major physical and philosophical blocks to a radically new way of perceiving reality. With no ether and no concept of absolute motion to confuse the situation became much simpler. Einstein's next step was to confront the puzzle which had come to light, no pun, in the Michelson-Morley experiment, namely the constancy of the speed of light. How could the speed of light always be 186,000 miles per second, regardless of the state of motion of the observer? In an ingenious mental turnaround, Einstein turned this puzzle into a postulate. Instead of worrying for the moment about how it can happen, he simply accepted the experimentally irrefutable fact that it does happen. This evident, to us, recognition of the obvious was the first step in a logical process which, once set in motion, was to explain not only the puzzle of the constant speed of light, but a great deal more. The puzzle of the constancy of the velocity of light became the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light. The principle of the constancy of the velocity of light is the first foundation stone of the special theory of relativity. The principle of the constancy of the velocity of light is that whenever we make a measurement of the velocity of light, regardless of whether we are in motion or at rest relative to the light source, we always get the same result. The speed of light is invariably 186,000 miles per second. Footnote: in a vacuum, the speed of light changes in matter depending upon the index of refraction of the matter. End of footnote. This is what Michelson and Morley discovered in their famous experiment. From the point of view of classical mechanics, the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light makes no sense at all. In fact, it conflicts violently with common sense. Before Einstein, the totalitarian grasp of common sense held the constancy of the speed of light to the status of a paradox. Whenever we bump into the limits of our self-imposed cognitive reality, the result is always paradox. It took a pure beginner's mind, such as Albert Einstein's, to accept that if what is the constancy of the velocity of light, then common sense must be wrong. The most important victim of Einstein's beginner's mind was the whole structure of classical Galilean transformations, that sweet but illusory fruit of a common sense anchored in macroscopic dimensions and velocities. To give up common sense is not an easy task. Einstein was the first person to do it in such a wholesale manner that his perception of the very nature of space and time changed radically. Moreover, when all was said and done, Einstein's vision of space and time turned out to be more useful than that of common sense. The second foundation stone of the special theory of relativity is the principle of relativity. When Einstein dismissed the idea of absolute non-motion, his theory became, ipso facto, a theory of relativity. Since there was no better principle of relativity to be had than Galileo's, Einstein simply borrowed it, but first, of course, he brought it up to date. Galileo's principle of relativity says that the laws of mechanics, such as the laws governing falling bodies, that are valid in one frame of reference are valid in all frames of reference that move uniformly, without jerkiness, in relation to it. Another way of saying the same thing is that it is impossible to determine, by doing experiments involving the laws of mechanics, whether or not our frame of reference is moving or at rest in relation to another frame of reference in which the laws of mechanics also are valid. Einstein expanded the Galilean relativity principle to include all the laws of physics, and not just the laws of classical mechanics. In particular, he included the laws governing electromagnetic radiation, which were unknown in Galileo's time. Einstein's updated principle of relativity, then, is that all the laws of nature are exactly identical in all frames of reference that move uniformly relative to each other, and that therefore there is no way of distinguishing absolute uniform motion or non-motion. In short, the two foundation stones of the special theory of relativity are the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light, the Michelson-Morley experiment, and the principles of relativity, Galileo. Said more specifically, the special theory of relativity rests upon these two postulates. 1. The velocity of light in a vacuum is the same in all frames of reference for all observers moving uniformly relative to each other. And 2. All laws of nature are the same in all frames of reference moving uniformly relative to each other. Of these two postulates, the first one, the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light, is the troublemaker. There is no way that it and the classical transformation laws both can be true. According to the classical transformation laws and common sense, the speed of light must be its velocity as it is emitted from a source, plus or minus the velocity of the observer, if the observer is moving toward the source or away from the source. According to experiment, the speed of light remains constant regardless of the state of motion of the observer. Common sense and experimental findings are in violent disagreement. Einstein's beginner's mind told him that since we cannot argue with what is, the experimental evidence, then our common sense must be wrong. With this decision to disregard common sense and to base his new theory on the only clothes he could see that the emperor was wearing, the constant speed of light and the principle of relativity, Einstein stepped boldly into the unknown, in fact, into the unimaginable. Already on new territory, he proceeded to explore where no person had gone before. How could it be that to every observer the speed of light is the same regardless of their state of motion? To measure speed, it is necessary to use a clock and ruler, a rigid rod. If the speed of light as measured by an observer at rest relative to a light source is the same as the speed of light as measured by an observer in motion relative to the source, then it must be that somehow the measuring instruments change from one frame of reference to the other in just such a way that the speed of light always appears to be the same. The speed of light appears constant because the rods and clocks used to measure it vary from one frame of reference to another depending upon their motion. In short, to an observer at rest, a moving rod changes its length and a moving clock changes its rhythm. At the same time, to an observer traveling along with a moving rod and clock, there is no apparent change at all in length or rhythm. Therefore, both observers measure the speed of light to be the same, and neither can detect anything unusual in the measurement or in the measuring apparatus. This is very similar to the case of the Michelson-Morley experiment. According to Fitzgerald and Lawrence, the arm of the interferometer that faces into the ether wind, now dismissed from our theory, is shortened by the pressure of the ether wind. Therefore, the light that travels the interferometer arm facing into the ether wind has less distance to travel and more time to do it in than does the light traveling the other arm. As a result, the speed of light traveling both arms appears to be the same. This is what the Lorentz transformations describe. Come to think of it, the Lorentz transformations can be used to describe contractions due to motion, as well as contractions due to a fictitious ether wind. Fitzgerald and Lorentz imagined that rigid rods were compressed under the pressure of the ether wind, but according to Einstein, it is motion itself that causes contraction, and in addition, time dilation. Here is another way of looking at it. A constant velocity of light is exactly what would result if moving measuring rods became shorter and moving clocks ran more slowly, because a moving observer would measure the speed of light with a shorter measuring rod, less distance for the light to travel, and a slower clock, more time to do it in, than an observer at rest. Each observer, however, would consider his own rod and clock to be quite normal and unimpaired. Therefore, both observers would find the speed of light to be 186,000 miles per second, and both of them would be puzzled by this fact if they were still bound by the classical transformation laws. These were the initial fruits of Einstein's basic assumptions, the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light and the principle of relativity. First, a moving object appears to contract in its direction of motion and become shorter as its velocity increases until, at the speed of light, it disappears altogether. Second, a moving clock runs more slowly than a clock at rest and continues to slow its rhythm as its velocity increases until, at the speed of light, it stops running altogether. These effects only appear to a stationary observer, one who is at rest relative to the moving clock and rod. They do not appear to an observer who is traveling along with the clock and rod. To make this clear, Einstein introduced the labels proper and relative. What we see when we observe our stationary rod and our stationary clock, if we ourselves are stationary, is their proper length and proper time. Proper means one's own. Proper lengths and proper times always appear normal. What we see if we are stationary and observe a rod and a clock traveling very fast relative to us is the relative length of the moving rod and the relative time of the moving clock. The relative length is always shorter than the proper length, and the relative time is always slower than the proper time. The time that you see on your own watch is your proper time, and the time that you see on the watch of the person moving past you is the relative time, which appears to you, not to the person moving past you, to run more slowly. The length of the measuring rod in your own hand is its proper length, and the length of the measuring rod in the hand of the person moving past you is its relative length, which appears to you, but not to the other person, to be shorter. From the point of view of the person moving past you, he is at rest, you are moving, and the situation is reversed. Suppose that we are aboard a spacecraft outward bound on an exploration. We have made arrangements to press a button every 15 minutes to send a signal back to Earth. As our speed steadily increases, our Earthbound colleagues notice that instead of every 15 minutes, our signals begin to arrive 17 minutes apart and then 25 minutes apart. After several days, our colleagues, to their distress, find that our signals arrive every 2 days. As our velocity continues to increase, our signals become years apart. Eventually, generations of Earthlings come and go between our signals. Meanwhile, on the spacecraft, we are entirely unaware of the predicament back on Earth. As far as we are concerned, everything is proceeding according to plan, although we are becoming bored with the routine of pressing a button every 15 minutes. When we return to Earth, a few years older, our proper time, we may find that we have been gone, according to Earth time, for centuries, their relative time. Exactly how long depends upon how fast we have been going. This scene is not science fiction. It is based upon a well-known, to physicists, phenomenon called the twin paradox of the special theory of relativity. Part of the paradox is that one twin remains on Earth while the other goes on a space voyage and returns younger than his brother. There are many examples of proper time and relative time. Suppose that we are in a space station observing an astronaut who is traveling at a speed of 161,000 miles per second relative to us. As we watch him, we notice a certain sluggishness in his movements, as though he were moving in slow motion. We also notice that everything in his spaceship also seems to function in slow motion. His rolled cigarette, for example, lasts twice as long as one of ours. Of course, part of his sluggishness is due to the fact that he is fast increasing the distance between us, and with each passing moment it takes the light from his spaceship longer to reach us. Nonetheless, after making allowances for the travel time of the light involved, we find that the astronaut still is moving more slowly than usual. However, to the astronaut, it is we who are zipping past him at 161,000 miles per second, and after he makes all the necessary allowances, he finds that it is we who are sluggish. Our cigarette lasts twice as long as his. This situation could be the ultimate illustration of how the grass is always greener on the other side. Each man's cigarette lasts twice as long as the other's. Unfortunately, so does each man's trip to the dentist. The time that we ourselves experience and measure is our proper time. Our cigarette lasts the normal length of time. The time that we measure for the astronaut is the relative time. His cigarette appears to last twice as long as ours because his time passes twice as slowly. The situation is similar regarding proper lengths and relative lengths. From our point of view, the astronaut's cigarette, provided that it is pointing in the direction that his spaceship is moving, is shorter than our own cigarette. The other side of the coin is that the astronaut sees himself as stationary and his cigarettes as normal. He also sees us as traveling at 161,000 miles per second relative to him, and our cigarettes as shorter than his and slower burning. Einstein's theory has been substantiated in many ways. All of them verify it with awesome accuracy. The most common verifications of time dilation come from high-energy particle physics. A very light elementary particle, called a muon, is created at the top of the Earth's atmosphere by the collision of protons, one form of cosmic radiation, and air molecules. We know from experiments in which muons are created in accelerators that they live a very short time. By no means do they live long enough to reach the Earth from the upper atmosphere. Long before the time it takes to traverse this distance, they should decay spontaneously into other types of particles. Yet this does not happen, because we detect them in abundance here at the Earth's surface. Why do the muons created by cosmic radiation live longer, in fact, 7 times longer than those muons created in the laboratory? The answer is that the muons produced by collisions of cosmic radiation and air molecules travel much faster than any muons that we can create experimentally. Their velocity is approximately 99% of the speed of light. At that speed, time dilation is quite noticeable. They do not live longer than usual from their point of view, but from our point of view, they live 7 times longer than they would at slower velocities. This is true not only of muons, but of almost all subatomic particles, and there are many of them. For example, pions, another type of subatomic particle, which move at 80% of the speed of light, live, on the average, 1.67 times as long as slow pions. The special theory of relativity tells us that the intrinsic lifetime of these high-speed particles does not increase, but that their relative rate of time flow slows down. The special theory of relativity also made the calculation of these phenomena possible long before we had the technical capability to create them. In 1972, 4 of the most accurate atomic clocks available were put aboard an aircraft and flown around the world. At the end of the trip, they were found to be slightly behind their stationary earthbound counterparts with which they were synchronized before the flight. The next time that you fly, remember that even if minutely, your watch is running slower, your body has more mass, and if you stand facing the cockpit, you are thinner. According to the special theory of relativity, a moving object appears to contract in the direction of motion as its velocity increases. James Terrell, a physicist, has demonstrated mathematically that this phenomenon is something like a visual illusion, and in fact is analogous to a projection of the real world onto the wall of Plato's cave. Plato's famous parable of the cave describes a group of people who are chained inside a cave in such a way that they can see only the shadows on the wall of the cave. These shadows are the only world that these people know. One day, one of these people escapes into the world outside the cave. At first, he is blinded by the sunlight, but when he recovers, he realizes that this is the real world, and what he previously considered to be the real world was, in fact, only the projection of the real world onto the wall of the cave. Unfortunately, when he returned to the people who were still chained inside the cave, they thought he was mad. Imagine a person standing looking at a sphere. Draw two lines connecting the person's eyes with points on either side of the sphere. If the person is far enough away from the sphere, the distance between these points is almost equal to the diameter of the sphere. The first step in Terrell's explanation is to draw new lines downward from each of the two points on the sphere to a screen directly below the sphere. Now, to understand Terrell's explanation, suppose that the sphere is moving very fast, relative to the speed of light, from right to left. If the sphere moves fast enough, some very interesting things happen. For example, before the light from the point on the far left edge of the sphere can reach us, the ball moves in front of it, blocking it from our vision. The reverse happens on the far right. The ball moves out from between us and the light signals originating from points that used to be on the back side of the ball. These signals now are visible to us, while the signals coming from the point that used to be on the leading edge of the ball now are blocked by the ball itself as it moves to the left. The effect of this is an illusion of sorts. What we see is the same thing that we would see if someone had rotated the ball around its axis. Now, look what happens to the distance between the two points we have projected on the screen below the ball. The distance is considerably less than when we started. The equations in the special theory of relativity, the Lorentz transformations, which show a contraction due to motion, describe these projections. Is this beginning to sound like Plato's cave? The fact that the ball, by moving fast enough, gets in the way of some of its own light signals and out of the way of others, causes the ball to appear to rotate. This causes the projected distance between any two points on it, which are aligned with the direction of motion, to decrease, just as if someone really had rotated the ball. The faster the ball moves, the more it appears to rotate, and the closer together come the points projected on the screen below the ball. It is the projection that contracts. Instead of screen, substitute view of the ball from our frame of reference, and we have the Terrell explanation of relativistic contraction. As yet, no analogous explanations have been found for the time dilation that accompanies moving clocks or the increase of mass that accompanies moving objects, but the effort, relatively speaking, is young. The special theory of relativity shows that the mass of a moving object increases as the velocity of the object increases. Newton would not have hesitated to call this nonsense, but then Newton's experience was limited to velocities that are quite slow compared to the speed of light. Classical physics tells us that a specific amount of force is required to increase the velocity of a moving object by a given amount, for example, 1 foot per second. Once we know what that amount of force is, whenever we want to increase the velocity of that particular object by 1 foot per second, all we need to do is apply that amount of force to it. If the object has a velocity of 100 feet per second, that specific amount of force will increase its velocity to 101 feet per second. According to Newton's physics, the same amount of force that increases the velocity of an object from 100 feet per second to 101 feet per second also will increase the velocity of the same object from 8,000 feet per second to 8,001 feet per second. The problem is that Newtonian physics is wrong. It takes much more force to increase by 1 foot per second the velocity of an object moving at 8,000 feet per second than it takes to increase by 1 foot per second the velocity of the same object moving at 100 feet per second. That is because a faster-moving object has more kinetic energy, energy of motion. This additional energy makes it behave exactly as if it had more mass. A given amount of force applied for a given amount of time will accelerate a single freight car to a greater velocity than the same amount of force applied for the same amount of time to an entire train. Of course, this is because an entire train has more mass than a single car. When particles travel at velocities that are fast relative to the speed of light, their high kinetic energy makes them behave as though they have more mass than they have at lower velocities. In fact, the special theory of relativity shows that the effective mass of a moving object does increase with velocity. Since most subatomic particles travel at different velocities, each one of them can have many different relative masses. Therefore, physicists have calculated the rest mass of each particle. The rest mass of a subatomic particle is its mass when it is not moving. Subatomic particles are never really at rest, but these calculations provide a uniform method of comparing their masses. This is necessary since as the velocity of a particle approaches the speed of light, its relative mass depends upon how fast it is moving. Einstein's discovery that moving clocks change their rhythm led to some spectacular revisions in the way that we see the world. It showed that there is no universal time that permeates the universe. There are only proper times associated with various observers. The proper time of each observer is different, unless two of them happen to be at rest relative to each other. If the universe has a heartbeat, its rate depends upon the hearer. The special theory of relativity shows that two events which happen at the same time in one frame of reference may occur at different times when seen from another frame of reference. To illustrate this point, Einstein used one of his famous thought experiments. A thought experiment is a mental exercise. It has the advantage of requiring no apparatus other than the mind, which frees it from the practical limitations of laboratory experiments. Most physicists accept the use of thought experiments as a valid theoretical tool, provided they are satisfied that if the experiment could be performed, the results of the actual experiment would be the same as those of the thought experiment. Suppose that we are in a moving room. The room is moving with a uniform velocity. Exactly in the center of the room is a light bulb, which flashes periodically. The room is made of glass so that an observer outside can see what happens inside. At the precise moment that we pass an outside observer, the light flashes. The question is there any difference between what we see inside the moving room and what the outside observer sees? According to the special theory of relativity, the answer is an extraordinary, concept-shattering yes. There is a big difference. Inside the room, we see the bulb flash, and we see the light spread out in all directions at the same speed. Since the walls of the room are equidistant from the bulb, we see the light strike the forward wall and rearward wall of the room simultaneously. The outside observer also sees the flash, and he also sees the light propagate in all directions at the same speed. However, in addition, he sees that the room is moving. From his point of view, the forward wall tries to escape the approaching light, while the rearward wall rushes to meet it. Therefore, to the outside observer, the light reaches the rearward wall before it reaches the forward wall. If the speed of the room is small compared to the speed of light, the light reaches the rearward wall only slightly ahead of the forward wall. Nonetheless, the light reaches the rearward and forward walls in a 1-2 order and not at the same time. Although both of us observed the same two events, the light striking the forward wall and the light striking the rearward wall, we each have different stories to tell. To us, inside the room, the two events were simultaneous. To the outside observer, one event came first and the other event came later. Einstein's revolutionary insight was that events which are simultaneous for one observer may occur at different times for another observer depending upon their relative motion. Put another way, two events, one of which occurs before the other is seen from the frame of reference of one observer, may occur at the same time when seen from the frame of reference of another observer. One observer uses the words sooner and later. The other observer uses the word simultaneous, even though both of them are describing the same two events. In other words, sooner, later, and simultaneous are local terms. They have no meaning in the universe at large unless they are tied down to a specific frame of reference. What is sooner in one frame of reference may be later in another frame of reference, and simultaneous in a third. The mathematics which translate what an observer in one frame of reference sees into what an observer in another frame of reference sees are the Lorentz transformations. Einstein adopted the Lorentz transformations, which are a set of equations, virtually intact. No one before Einstein got these startling results from this simple type of thought experiment because no one before Einstein had the audacity to postulate something as outrageous as the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light. No one had the audacity to postulate something as outrageous as the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light because the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light completely and unequivocally contradicts common sense. Specifically, common sense as represented by the classical transformation laws. The classical transformation laws are so embedded in our everyday experience that it simply never occurred to anybody to question them. Even when the Michelson-Morley experiment produced results that were incompatible with the classical transformation laws, no beginner's mind but Einstein's conceived that the classical transformation laws might be wrong. Only Einstein suspected that at very high velocities, velocities far faster than those that we encounter through our senses, the classical transformation laws do not apply. This is not to say that they are incorrect. At low velocities, compared to 186,000 miles per second, contraction and time dilation are not detectable sensorily. In this limited situation, the classical transformations are a good guide for practical experience. After all, we do reach the top of an escalator faster if we walk. If we do the moving room experiment with sound instead of light, we do not get the special theory of relativity. We get a confirmation of the classical transformation laws. There is no principle of the constancy of the velocity of sound because the velocity of sound is not constant. It varies depending upon the motion of the observer, hearer, as dictated by common sense. The important word here is dictated. We live out our lives in a limited situation of low velocities where the speed of sound, about 700 miles per hour, seems fast. Therefore, our common sense is based upon our experiences in this limited environment. If we want to expand our understanding beyond the limitations of this environment, it is necessary to drastically rearrange our conceptual constructs. This is what Einstein did. He was the first person to see that this is what had to be done in order to make sense of such impossible experimental findings as the constancy of the velocity of light for each and every person who measures it, regardless of their states of motion. This led him to turn the puzzle of the constancy of the velocity of light into the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light. In turn, that led him to the conclusion that if the velocity of light really is constant for all observers, then the measuring instruments used by different observers in different states of motion somehow must vary so that all of them give the same result. By a stroke of luck, Einstein discovered that these same variances were expressed in the equations of the Dutch physicist Hendrik Lorentz, and so he borrowed them. Lastly, the fact that moving clocks change their rhythm led Einstein to the inescapable conclusion that now, sooner, later, and simultaneous are relative terms. They all depend upon the state of motion of the observer. This conclusion is precisely the opposite of the assumption upon which Newtonian physics is based. Newton assumed, as did we all, that there is one clock ticking off the seconds by which the entire universe grows older. For every second of time that passes in this corner of the universe, 1 second of time passes also in every other corner of the universe. According to Einstein, this is incorrect. How can anyone say when it is now throughout the universe? If we try to designate now by the occurrence of two simultaneous events, like my arrival at the doctor's office and my watch indicating 3 o'clock, we find that an observer in another frame of reference sees one of our events happening before the other. Absolute time, wrote Newton, flows equably. But he was wrong. There is no single time which flows equally for all observers. There is no absolute time. The existence of one ultimate flow of time throughout the physical universe, which we all tacitly acknowledged, turned out to be another piece of clothing that the emperor wasn't wearing. Newton made one more mistake in this regard. He said that time and space were separate. According to Einstein, time and space are not separate. Something cannot exist at some place without existing at some time, and neither can it exist at some time without existing at some place. Most of us think of space and time as separate because that is the way that we think that we experience them. For example, we seem to have some control over our position in space, but none at all over our position in time. There is nothing that we can do about the flow of time. We can choose to stand perfectly still, in which case our position in space does not change, but there is no way that we can stand still in time. This notwithstanding, there is something very elusive about space, and especially about time, something that prevents us from resting our accounts with them prematurely. Subjectively, time has a fluid quality which much resembles a running brook, sometimes bubbling past in a furious rush, sometimes slipping by quietly unnoticed, and sometimes lying languid, almost stationary in deep pools. Space, too, has an ubiquitous quality about it which belies the common notion that it serves only to separate things. William Blake's famous poem reaches out toward these intangible qualities. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. Its title, by no coincidence, is Auguries of Innocence. The special theory of relativity is a physical theory. Its concern is with the mathematically calculable nature of reality. It is not the theory of subjectivity. Although it shows that the appearances of physical reality may vary from one frame of reference to another, it is a theory about the unchanging, physicists say invariant, aspect of physical reality. Nonetheless, the special theory of relativity was the first mathematically rigorous physical theory to explore areas whose expression previously had been the domain of poets. Like any concise and poignant re-presentation of reality, the theories of relativity are poetry to mathematicians and physicists. However, Albert Einstein's enormous public renown perhaps was due in part to a shared intuition that he had something profoundly relevant to say about space and time. What Einstein had to say about space and time is that there is no such thing as space and time. There is only space-time, the two words hyphenated. Space-time is a continuum. A continuum is something whose parts are so close together, so arbitrarily small, that the continuum really cannot be broken down into them. There are no breaks in a continuum. It is called a continuum because it flows continuously. For example, a one-dimensional continuum is a line drawn on a wall. Theoretically, we might say that the line is comprised of a series of points, but the points are each infinitely close to one another. The result is that the line flows continuously from one end of it to the other. An example of a two-dimensional continuum is the wall. It has two dimensions, length and width. Similarly, all of the points on the wall are in contact with other points on the wall, and the wall itself is a continuous surface. A three-dimensional continuum is what we commonly call space. A pilot flying his airplane navigates in a three-dimensional continuum. To give his location, he must state, for example, not only how far north and how far east of a given point he is, but he also must report his altitude. The airplane itself, like all things physical, is three-dimensional. It has a width, a height, and a depth. This is why mathematicians call our reality, their reality too, three-dimensional. According to Newtonian physics, our three-dimensional reality is separate from and moves forward in a one-dimensional time. Not so, says the special theory of relativity. Our reality is four-dimensional, and the fourth dimension is time. We live, breathe, and exist in a four-dimensional space-time continuum. The Newtonian view of space and time is a dynamic picture. Events develop with the passage of time. Time is one-dimensional and moves forward. The past, present, and future happen in that order. The special theory of relativity, however, says that it is preferable and more useful to think in terms of a static, non-moving picture of space and time. This is the space-time continuum. In this static picture, the space-time continuum events do not develop, they just are. If we could view our reality in a four-dimensional way, we would see that everything that now seems to unfold before us with the passing of time already exists in toto, painted, as it were, on the fabric of space-time. we would see all, the past, the present, and the future with one glance. Of course, this is only a mathematical proposition, isn't it? Don't worry about visualizing a four-dimensional world. Physicists can't do it either. For the moment, just assume that Einstein might be right, since the evidence so far suggests that he is. His message is that space and time are related in an intimate manner. For lack of a better way of saying it, he expressed this relationship by calling time a fourth dimension. Fourth dimension is a translation from one language to another. The original language is mathematics, and the second language is English. The problem is that there is simply no way of precisely expressing what the first language says in terms of the second language. Therefore, time as a fourth dimension is merely a label that we give to a relationship. The relationship in question is the relationship between space and time as it is expressed mathematically in the theories of relativity. The relationship between space and time that Einstein discovered is similar to the relationship between the sides of a right triangle, which Pythagoras the Greek, a contemporary of Confucius, discovered about 550 BC. A right triangle is a triangle that contains a right angle. A right angle is formed whenever two perpendicular lines intersect. The side of a right triangle that is opposite the right angle is called the hypotenuse. The hypotenuse is always the longest side of a right triangle. Pythagoras discovered that as long as we know the length of the two shorter sides of a right triangle, we can calculate the length of the longest side. This relationship, expressed mathematically, is the Pythagorean theorem. The first leg squared plus the second leg squared equals the hypotenuse squared. The hypotenuse of a given length can be calculated from many different combinations of shorter legs. In other words, there are many combinations of different sized legs that all calculate to have the same hypotenuse. For example, the first leg might be very short and the second leg very long. Or the other way round, or anything in between. If we substitute space for one of the legs of a right triangle, time for the other leg, and space-time interval for the hypotenuse, we have a relationship which is conceptually analogous to the relationship between space-time and the space-time interval described in the special theory of relativity. The space-time interval between two events is an absolute. It never varies. It can appear differently to observers in different states of motion, but it is itself invariant. The special theory of relativity shows how observers in different frames of reference can observe the same two events and calculate the space-time interval between them. The answer that all of the observers get will be the same. One observer may be in a state of motion such that for him there is a time and a distance involved between the two events, and another observer may be in a state of motion such that his measuring devices indicate a different distance and a different time between the events, but the space-time interval between the two events does not vary. For example, the space-time interval, the absolute separation, between two exploding stars is the same whether it is viewed from a slow-moving frame of reference, like a planet, or from a fast-moving frame of reference, like a speeding rocket. Let us return to our experiment with the moving glass room. Although we inside the room saw the light strike the rearward and forward walls simultaneously, the outside observer saw the light strike the rearward wall before it reached the forward wall. Nevertheless, by using a Pythagorean-like equation, into which we and the outside observer feed our time and distance measurements, we both get the same space-time interval between the events. Actually, this Pythagorean-like relationship was the discovery of Einstein's mathematics teacher, Hermann Minkowski, who was inspired by his most famous student's special theory of relativity. In 1908, Minkowski announced his vision this way: "Henceforth, space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of union of the two will preserve an independent reality." Minkowski's mathematical explorations of space and time were both revolutionary and fascinating. Out of them came a simple diagram of space-time showing the mathematical relationship of the past, present, and the future. Of the wealth of information contained in this diagram, the most striking is that all of the past and all of the future for each individual meet and forever meet at a single point, now, Furthermore, the now of each individual is specifically located and will never be found in any other place than here, wherever the observer is at. 63 years before Ram Dass's great book, Be Here Now, established the watchwords of the awareness movement, Hermann Minkowski proved that in physical reality, no choice exists in the matter. Pun. Unfortunately for physicists, the realization is not always the experience. Nonetheless, after 2,000 years of use in the East, being here now, the beginning step in meditation, received the validation of Western science via Minkowski's rigorous mathematical confirmation of it, inspired by the special theory of relativity. The last and the most famous aspect of the special theory of relativity is the revelation that mass is a form of energy and that energy has mass. In Einstein's words, energy has mass and mass represents energy. Although this sounds shocking in one sense, in the sense that we have believed ever so long that matter, stuff, is different from energy, just as the body is different from the mind, another form of the same theory, in another sense it sounds surprisingly natural. The matter-energy dichotomy goes back at least as far as the Old Testament. Genesis portrays man as a sort of ceramic creation. God scoops up a handful of clay, matter, and breathes life, energy, into it. The Old Testament is a product of the Western world, or the other way around. Physics also is a product of the Western world. In the East, however, there never has been much philosophical or religious, only in the West are these two separate, confusion about matter and energy. In the East, however, there has never been much philosophical or religious, only in the West are these two separate, confusion about matter and energy. The world of matter is a relative world, and an illusory one. Illusory not in the sense that it does not exist, but illusory in the sense that we do not see it as it really is. The way it really is cannot be communicated verbally, but in the attempt to talk around it, Eastern literature speaks repeatedly of dancing energy and transient, impermanent forms. This is strikingly similar to the picture of physical reality emerging from high-energy particle physics. Buddhist literature does not speak of learning new things about reality, but about removing veils of ignorance that stand between us and what we already are. Perhaps this accounts for the fact that the preposterous claim that mass is only a form of energy is unexpectedly palatable. The formula which expresses the relationship of mass to energy is the most famous formula in the world, E equals mc squared. The energy contained in a piece of matter is equal to the mass of the matter multiplied by an extraordinarily large number, the speed of light squared. This means that even the tiniest, the very tiniest particle of matter has within it a tremendous amount of concentrated energy. Although Einstein didn't know it at the time, he discovered the secret of stellar energy. Stars continuously convert matter into energy. It is because of the very large ratio of energy released to matter consumed that stars can continue to burn through countless millennia. At the center of a star, hydrogen atoms, the primordial stuff of the physical world, are squeezed together so tightly by the enormous gravitational force of the star's dense mass that they fuse together, making a new element, helium. Every four hydrogen atoms become one helium atom. However, the mass of one helium atom is not the same as the mass of four hydrogen atoms. It is slightly less. This small difference in mass is released as radiant energy, heat and light. The process of fusing lighter elements into heavier elements is called, of course, fusion. The fusion of hydrogen into helium causes a hydrogen explosion. In other words, a young, burning star is one huge, continuously exploding hydrogen bomb. The formula E equals mc squared also resulted in the atomic bomb. Atomic bombs and atomic reactors obtain energy from mass by the process of fission, which is the opposite of fusion. Instead of fusing smaller atoms into larger ones, the process of fission splits atoms of uranium, which are quite large, into atoms which are smaller. This is done by firing a subatomic particle, a neutron, at an atom of uranium. When the neutron hits the uranium atom, it splits into lighter atoms, but the mass of these smaller atoms together is less than the mass of the parent atom of uranium. The difference in mass explodes into energy. This process also produces additional neutrons which fly off to strike other uranium atoms, creating more fissions, more light atoms, more energy, and more neutrons. The whole phenomenon is called a chain reaction. An atomic bomb is an uncontrolled chain reaction. A hydrogen fusion bomb is produced by detonating an atomic fission bomb in the midst of hydrogen. The heat from the atomic explosion, in place of the heat of friction caused by gravity, fuses hydrogen atoms into helium atoms and releases heat in the process, which fuses together more hydrogen atoms, releasing more heat, and so on. There is no limit to the size of a potential hydrogen bomb, and it is constructed from the most plentiful element in the universe. For better or worse, a major revelation of the special theory of relativity is that mass and energy are different forms of the same thing. Like space and time, they are not separate entities. There is no qualitative difference between mass and energy. There is only mass-energy, hyphenated. Mathematically, this discovery meant that the two conservation laws of mass and energy could be replaced by a single conservation law of mass-energy. A conservation law is a simple statement that a quantity of something, whatever it may be, never changes, no matter what happens. For example, suppose that there were a conservation law governing the number of guests at a party. If such a thing were true, we would notice that every time a new guest arrived at the party, some other guest would leave. Similarly, every time a guest at the party left, another one would arrive. The rate of guest turnover at the party might be great or small, and the guests might arrive and depart singly or in groups, but in all circumstances, the number of guests at the party would remain the same. The conservation law concerning energy says that the total amount of energy in the universe always has been and always will be the same. We can convert energy from one form to another, like mechanical energy to thermal energy via friction, but the total amount of energy in the universe does not change. Similarly, the law of conservation of matter says that the total amount of matter in the universe always has been and always will be the same. We can convert matter from one form to another, like ice to water or water to steam, but the total amount of matter in the universe does not change. When the special theory of relativity combined mass and energy into mass energy, it also combined the law of the conservation of mass and the law of the conservation of energy into the law of the conservation of mass energy. The law of the conservation of mass energy says that the total amount of mass energy in the universe always has been and always will be the same. Mass may be converted into energy and energy may be converted into mass, but the total amount of mass energy in the universe does not change. The sun, the stars, even wood burning in the fireplace are examples of mass being converted into energy. Physicists who study subatomic particles are so familiar with the concept of exchanging mass for energy and energy for mass that they routinely designate the mass size of particles in terms of their energy content. In all, there are roughly 12 conservation laws. These simple laws are becoming more and more important, especially in high-energy particle physics, because they are derived from what physicists now believe to be the ultimate principles, latest dance, governing the physical world. These are the laws of symmetry. The laws of symmetry are pretty much what they sound like. Something is symmetrical if certain aspects of it remain the same under varying conditions. For example, one half of a circle mirrors the other half, no matter how we cut it. Regardless of how we turn a circle, the right half always mirrors the left half. The position of the circle changes, but its symmetry remains. The Chinese have a similar concept, perhaps the same. One side of a circle is called yin, and the other side is called yang. There is yin, there is yang. Where there is high, there is also low. Where there is day, there also is night. Where there is death, there also is birth. The concept of yin-yang, which is really a very old law of symmetry, is yet another way of saying that the physical universe is a whole which seeks balance within itself. The irony of the special theory of relativity, as apparent by now, is that it is not about those aspects of reality that are relative, but about those aspects that are not relative. Like quantum mechanics, its impact on the assumptions of Newtonian physics was shattering. not because it proved them wrong, but because it proved them to be quite limited. The special theory of relativity and quantum mechanics have propelled us into unimaginably expansive areas of reality, areas about which we literally had not one previous idea. The assumptions of Newtonian physics correspond to the clothes we always thought that the emperor was wearing, a universal time whose uniform passage equally affects every part of the universe, a separate space, independent though empty, and the belief that there exists somewhere in the universe a place which stands absolutely still, quiet, and unmoving. Every one of these assumptions has been proven untrue, not useful, by the special theory of relativity. The emperor wasn't wearing them at all. The only motion in the physical universe is motion relative to something else. There is no separate space and time. Mass and energy are different names for the same thing. In place of these assumptions, the special theory of relativity provides a new and unified physics. Measurements of distance and duration may vary from one frame of reference to another, but the space-time interval between events never changes. For all this, however, the special theory of relativity has one shortcoming. It is based on a rather uncommon situation. The special theory of relativity applies only to frames of reference that move uniformly, relative to each other. Most movement, unfortunately, is neither constant nor ideally smooth. In other words, the special theory of relativity is built upon an idealization. It is limited to and premised upon the special situation of uniform motion. That is why Einstein called it the special or restricted theory. Einstein's vision was to construct a physics that is valid for all frames of reference, such as those moving with non-uniform motion, acceleration and deceleration, relative to each other, as well as those moving uniformly relative to each other. His idea was to create a physics which could describe events in terms of any frame of reference, no matter how it moves, relative to any other frame of reference. In 1915, Einstein succeeded in achieving the complete generalization of his special theory. He called this achievement the general theory of relativity.